This is Dominic Preziosi, editor of Commonweal. What is the purpose, value, and responsibility of the institution known as the university? These questions have been asked for many years, but have taken on a distinct resonance today. Events like Israel's war in Gaza have sparked fresh, contentious battles about protest and free speech on campus, the soaring costs of higher education and staggering levels of student debt, as well as last year's Supreme Court decision overturning affirmative action, raise concerns about access and affordability. Even the liberal arts curriculum that has traditionally united universities is being dismantled for budgetary and ideological reasons. Here to talk about all of this is Nicholas Dirks, president and chief executive officer of the New York Academy of Sciences and former chancellor of the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of the new book, City of Intellect, The Uses and Abuses of the University. My conversation with him is coming right up on the Commonweal podcast. Hi, Nick Dirks. Thanks for being with us on the Commonweal podcast.
Great to be here with you, Dominic.
So I want to talk a bit about the debate over speech on college campuses, which is obviously a very live issue, and we're in a fraught time, and it seems we've been working our way up to this moment. So we've seen universities are under pressure from one side with donors and alumni, sometimes very high profile, very wealthy alumni, and in the other from departments and student bodies about how to respond to events. And politically, they're getting challenged from both the right and left. So last fall, Tom Ginsburg, a professor of law at the University of Chicago, made the case for university silence in the online publication Persuasion. And he wrote, "When school administrations speak authoritatively about contested questions, they not only discourage individual inquiry, but also unleash a politics of lobbying that can never be satisfied." So having been a leader at major institutions of higher learning, what do you make of all of this? What should universities do in moments like these? And I know it's a broad question, but there's probably no other way of asking it. Should universities be silent?
So thank you for starting with the uncontentious questions that confront universities today. I was chancellor of UC Berkeley. I was there during a time that I thought was pretty contested in terms of political kinds of debates taking place. And we had some major incidents having to do both with concerns about controversial speakers coming to campus, questions around how the university would take a stand on different kinds of political issues. And I was there, of course, during the 2016 election of Donald Trump that raised even larger questions around the role of the university vis-a-vis students, for example, from undocumented backgrounds and other things like that, that were both in the news and under scrutiny, both from the administration in Washington, but also from donors and from alumni at every position on the political spectrum. So I feel like I've lived through a lot of this. Reverting to Tom Ginsburg from the University of Chicago, Chicago, where I, in the interest of full disclosure, I did my graduate work, is a great university, and it's staked out a position around neutrality that is quite distinctive, I think, among universities today. And it all goes back to what was called the Calvin Report of 1967 that denunciated a position of institutional neutrality. Now, it's important to remember that 1967 was a time when there was growing pressure on university administrators around things that began in Berkeley with the free speech movement in 1964, but of course took off both in relationship to civil rights agitations on campus and then increasingly around Vietnam and then Cambodia. And universities were pretty contested places in those days, and I did happen to spend a bit of time in universities then, so none of this should be entirely new. But I talk about that context and background because what effectively Chicago was trying to figure out was how not to take positions on political issues around, for example, military recruitment on campus or their support of the war in Vietnam or other kinds of issues like that. And I was part of a generation, you know, I was young, I wasn't in university at that point yet, but I soon was. And I felt that universities needed to be a little more outspoken and certainly needed to accommodate the kinds of concerns that the students had about involvement in what we thought was an unjust war at the time. I say that because I didn't see the Calvin Report as being a completely neutral statement. It was actually trying to avoid a certain kind of conversation. Having said that, I was so much younger then, and I had gone through different stages of being a student professor at every level, and then a dean, and then a chancellor. And I came increasingly to recognize that in positions of administrative authority on universities, one had to adopt a somewhat neutral and an independent kind of perspective in order precisely not to chill conversations that are taking place, positions that are held, and sometimes even protests that are being conducted from very different kinds of political positions. And so increasingly, I came to hold that a certain level of institutional neutrality was in fact necessary. Now, as you know, Ginsburg says in his quote, lobbying takes place, and I was lobbied repeatedly to make comments. Mm-hmm. And I tried not to make comments that were directly about things like, say, foreign policy. I tried to say that the purpose of the university was to encourage a deep and learned study, but also serious and impassioned debate about the issues of the time, and therefore the university as such should not take a position with respect to them. Mm-hmm. But I also recognized that there were statements that I made, statements that colleagues across other universities made, that enunciated the values of the university that were seen by some, mostly on the right, but sometimes on the left as well, as political statements. So it's very hard, in other words, to actually draw a line and say, this is where I'm going to be neutral, and that is where I'm going to talk about values. Mm-hmm. And that is always going to be a contested line. So I say that because I actually agree that university administrations have been called upon too often to make political statements, and then reactions take place around what happened most recently and calls for moral clarity instead of whatever political analysis. But on the other hand, I think it's a contested line and not an easy one to maintain.
Mm. Even in the way you answer that question and some of the ideas you bring up and concepts you use, hint at my next question, I guess, in a way. You're a vocal proponent of the humanities in higher education, and every day that passes, it seems that humanities are on the budget chopping block across the board, and not only at public universities, which rely on state funding and so face greater cost pressures, but even the nation's, what we think of as the nation's most prestigious institutions. There was a New York Times story noting that even Harvard, which is an endowment of more than $50 billion, formed a strategic planning committee to look at humanities education with an eye toward consolidation and cost cutting. Related to what we just were even beginning to talk about, there are the political motivations in states that tend to be maybe more conservative. The humanities are being targeted in a more ideological way. So how would you make the case for the importance of the humanities today, especially at a time when people now seem to see higher education mostly as a way to train for careers?
As you said, I've been a passionate advocate for the humanities for my entire career at every level of every kind of position I've held across the university. And I've been watching the increasing sense of decline with growing alarm, I should say. Mm-hmm. The big decline began in the wake of the financial crisis of 2008-2009. Mm-hmm. I think there was a very direct correlation between the shakeup of our financial system and the growing concern on the part of students and their parents to focus increasingly on an education that could actually yield a good paying job. And I understand that. And of course, universities from their origins have been concerned to prepare students for careers. But the move in away from the humanities is more than just, I think, a reflection of that moment of crisis in our recent history. It actually builds on things that had been going on for some decades before, in which, A, there had been a kind of growing sense that the humanities were not really that important. Now, I'm a historian, so forgive me, but I'll do this, I hope, quickly. In some sense, the modern humanities began when the university stopped teaching theology, religion, and moral values in a direct way. And in the aftermath of World War I, where there was this sense that Europe had begun to go to seed, there was a very explicit effort on the part of universities like Columbia and Chicago and others to install a general humanities curriculum that would provide students with a sense of the great works of art and literature and culture, with a sense of restoring a sense of trust in Western civilization, and to use that civilization as a kind of moral compass for the lives these leaders would go on to have. But then, of course, in the aftermath of World War II, you have increasingly intellectual, political, social movements that begin to debunk high culture, and the humanities played a role in that, stressing critique perhaps rather than just the celebration of the past, calling attention to increasingly issues of exclusion in our history around race, around gender, around ethnicity, and even going to the point of engaging in radical forms of deconstructive theory that took everything, as it were, as an object of critique, and even the text itself was destabilized as a result of that. So you could look back and say the humanities have hoisted themselves on their own petard, and they no longer hold any place of value because they themselves had begun to dispense with that sense of value. And then the cost of higher education goes up and students are no longer thinking about what they're doing as a kind of rite of passage. They're thinking about it quite specifically in relationship to what career am I going to get and will I be able to pay back my student loans?
Yeah.
But I think the problem here is that the humanities are still the place where, you know, fundamental questions around what it means to be human, what it means to lead a good life, what it means to try to find ways to construct a decent society, and how to understand not only ourselves, but our neighbors, and indeed not just our proximate neighbors, but neighbors around the world, are in many respects more important than ever. And I would add to that list of things the fact that when you now confront issues that range from the kind of fear of dramatic climate change and extinction risks even that are associated with that, to the role that artificial intelligence, new technology, possible quantum computing plays in our everyday life. And it's going to be a growing place indeed, as we know from the last year and a half since the release of ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. The kinds of things that the humanities do, the function they play in our education, seems to me ever more critical. And I believe we need to find a way to, in some sense, re-valorize the role the humanities play in higher education so that we can interest students and others in the importance of these fields. And the last thing I'll just say is that to do this requires a lot of different people playing a part, but it also involves humanists in universities rethinking what they do, how they constitute themselves. There's a really interesting book that came out last year by a literary critic at NYU, John Guillory, called Professing Critique. And he acknowledges that to some extent, English as a discipline in universities in the late 20th century began to lose its way around precisely the issue of professionalization, which is where he uses the double entendre in professing, professor and professional. And I think what he does is put his finger on the extent to which the humanities have become too invested in their own disciplinary reproduction and too little concerned with rethinking how they can occupy a much larger space in the university to address the kinds of challenges that we're confronting, but also the need to continue to think about these questions of meaning, the social good, and the like as well.
Mm. So I think we want young students to be able to have access to an education like this, but accessibility is a real issue at the moment. There's the questions of who gets to attend, who can afford to attend, how to bring the cost of a college education within reach. And last year's Supreme Court decisions gave new resonance to these questions. The court ruled against affirmative action and also President Joseph Biden's debt relief plan. And I'm just wondering, where do you see ways to ensure greater accessibility? Are there steps that schools or political leaders need to take? Does this compel us to ask more difficult questions like just what is higher education for and who is it for?
Sure. I think those are questions that are always good ones to ask. And I think we have to ask them with a new kind of urgency. In 2011, I think, was the year that student debt went up above $1 trillion. It's now getting closer to $2 trillion, despite efforts on the part of President Biden to offer debt relief. The amount of debt around higher education is staggering, and it plays a huge role in both the lives that people lead after they leave a university, hopefully with a degree, but many times not, of course, but also with the way in which they think about the question of higher education and who it's for. The disallowing of affirmative action, which began, you know, in California in 1996 with the disallowing of any kind of affirmative action at the University of California, has had, I think, a kind of chilling effect on the sense of possibility for many young people, particularly from backgrounds that had not been well served by our society and certainly not well served by higher education. Affirmative action was an important way of acknowledging that and using admission to colleges and universities to try to redress the effect of exclusion of people from various backgrounds to the best of higher education. But in the midst of all of this, I think what gets lost a little bit in the debate is the fact that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, places like Berkeley were beacons of opportunity.
Right.
They were publicly funded. They were not expensive. Cost was really low. I was reminded of this periodically by Governor Jerry Brown, who kept telling me that when he went to Berkeley in the early 60s, he only paid $70 a semester. And I reminded him that's because the state was paying the rest. And the truth is, of course, the state was contributing far more. It was giving 70 75% of the budget. Whereas when I went to Berkeley, the state was providing only 12, 13% of the university budget. So if we're really going to address questions both of accessibility broadly and also cost, we're going to have to find other ways to fund students to go who can't otherwise afford this. And of course, college costs have gone up faster than anything other than healthcare. And of course, that's for an obvious reason. Both are dependent on relatively highly paid professional labor. And now that, you know, increasingly we're aware that technology can begin to not just perhaps replace us, become us, we're at a time when this is not going to be a conversation we can defer much longer. But it's going to require talking about more than just affirmative action. It's going to require that we think about cost. It will require that we think differently about questions of what real accessibility means and efforts to create perhaps a more diverse set of opportunities that are nevertheless really well done for students to get the kinds of educational opportunities, both of a general educational nature and of a vocational nature, that they're going to need for this rapidly changing world.
We'll have more of my conversation with Nicholas Dirks in a moment.
I'm Claudia Avila Cosnahan, Director of Mission and Partnerships at Commonweal. One thing I love about Commonweal is our spirit of curiosity. It shapes everything we do, from religion to politics to culture and the arts. Consider becoming a Commonweal associate today. Just visit commonwealmagazine.org/donate. Your gift helps support everything we do, including this podcast. Now let's get back to the conversation.
Recently, billionaire Michael Bloomberg and his Bloomberg Philanthropies announced a $250 million initiative to create new high schools around the nation that will graduate students directly into high-demand healthcare jobs with what his institute is calling family-sustaining wages. And I guess each school is supposed to provide traditional academic programming as well as specialized healthcare classes co-taught by health system employees using a co-designed curriculum. So is this the kind of, I guess, initiative or idea that you were just thinking about? Or is this the kind of program that could impact higher education in a positive way? Are there drawbacks?
You know, I feel a certain level of ambivalence about these kinds of programs. So on the one hand, it does provide a fast track and a well-funded fast track for jobs that are both important jobs for people to have and critical for our system to have the kind of healthcare workers that we need to staff our incredibly under-subscribed at the level of staff health systems. But on the other, you know, I see a lot getting lost in the shuffle because, of course, as I've been talking about, I believe that students from all kinds of backgrounds and students going on to all kinds of careers would benefit, and indeed society would benefit too, from their having the kinds of broad educational opportunities that every other student will have, regardless of social economic backgrounds. I've always felt that one of the great things about America vis-a-vis Europe, for example, was that we don't track students at an early age and separate them off into either a higher education track or a vocational track. And although I see the urgency of having real pathways, skilling pathways for students, especially in these kinds of domains, I also fear that this then becomes a way of simply avoiding the kind of discussion I was just saying we need, which is around public support for public higher education at an excellent level and both in high school and in post-secondary educational contexts.
I don't want to let go of the cost issue just yet, because I think there are a lot of critics of higher education at the moment who really zero in on the impact of higher administrative overhead or what some even call sort of bloated administration overall. There was a report recently that said MIT now has almost 8 times as many non-faculty employees as faculty employees. And I guess even the University of California system that you were involved with, the number of managers and senior professionals grew by 60% in 10 years between 2004 and 2014, while the number of tenure-track faculty members grew by just 8%. So doesn't this impact spending on teaching and curricula and student-specific programs? Does it not contribute to the higher costs of higher education?
It certainly does, but there are a lot of different reasons for this escalation in numbers around administrative positions. Some of them have to do with work in research, both in medical facilities as well in primarily in scientific and technical fields. There's much more in the way of compliance that has to be done around research, much of which is for a good reason. Research misconduct is a problem, but using federally funded dollars to advance research has to be done in the right way. And that does involve an administrative cadre that takes those numbers up. But while you can explain some of the increase in administrative numbers from these increased demands around compliance and support for research, you know, there's just been an explosion of administrative personnel across the board. Mm-hmm. Now, some of these have been in areas that I think many of us who critique administrative costs or university costs in part because of administration would actually be in favor of some of the things that have driven these costs up. For example, having offices that provide more support for diverse populations who are coming to college for the first time and really do sometimes need extra support in order to navigate to their own advantage the kinds of opportunities that exist, but which can easily become just impediments if you don't know how to get through them. So I mean, there's been a great deal of discussion around diversity, equity, and inclusion offices, and that kind of critique has come from the right for political reasons. But there were good reasons to say it wasn't enough just to bring in a diverse population of students. You had to actually support them when they came in. But again, if you look more broadly, you also see that faculty used to be much more involved in things like advising students than they are today. There's been a professionalization not only among faculty, but among staff. And I began a critical review when I was chancellor of Berkeley and dealt with a recurring structural deficit of $150 million a year to look at every administrative position, because it seemed to me anyway, that was the first place to look for cuts in terms of cost. And I accept that there have been instances where you see a kind of bureaucratic creep where, you know, the answer to every problem that confronts a bureaucracy is add another office.
Right.
And one does. At the University of California, there's an entirely parallel, almost university, a university without students and without faculty in the office of the president. And I felt often that bureaucracy had grown really beyond any kind of point of need and had become a parallel bureaucracy that, again, drove up costs. And of course, a lot of the stuff that they were doing was trying to standardize things across the 9 or 10 campuses of the University of California. But, you know, you have to look at this and say, what is really critical? In my book, I talk a lot about trying to both break down some of our assumptions about what a university is, what a university needs to do, how we allocate responsibility for the university when, in fact, the costs have become so big an impediment to the kind of accessibility we want for students.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned your book, because I do want to ask you some of the specific things you write about. And I want to mention something you say in the preface about how you see human agency. And you write that human agency is primarily about the quest to find and make meaning. And I know we've touched on this in this conversation a little bit already. I know also that we find ourselves in discussion with our readers at Commonweal, especially younger readers. And when I say younger, I think under 40, there seems to be this yearning for meaning in their lives, which they can't seem to locate in what we would have once considered, I guess, the traditional, familiar, reliable resources, community, family, religious tradition, civic life. What are some of the challenges today in the quest to find and make meaning? And where and how do you think that this quest can still be fulfilled?
So in my book, in the opening preface, I do talk about issues around human agency, and I talk about them at two levels. One, around a course I took early on in my college, in my time at college, on free will and necessity, and it was a course that was taught by a philosopher of religion on the one side and a behavioral psychologist on the other. And one thought that human agency was basically governed by a sense of freedom, and the other was of the conviction that human agency was basically dictated by stimulus and response. And I just found that incredibly interesting. It was interesting to me in part because two very smart people with arguments that seemed to be endless on their side of the ledger could agree to disagree in a very amiable way. And I thought that kind of modeled what a university should be. Mm-hmm. And that certainly has informed my sense of the university going forward. But the second was that I confessed that I had actually lost my own religious faith when I went to college. And I, to some extent, took up the kinds of questions in philosophy and literature and even politics as a way of thinking about issues of meaning that were new in the sense that they were no longer being governed, as it were, by my relationship to a church and the church in particular that I went to when I was growing up. So I do think a lot about this question, about what is the role of the university vis-a-vis these kinds of questions, especially at a time when, as you just said, those kinds of institutional pillars of community, church, family, and the like seem no longer to have the kind of pull that they did once upon a time, or at least that's how we look back on our history. And I do believe that universities are, both in terms of the ages of the people who go there and in terms of the kinds of things that universities allow you to do, namely to delve deeply into the thoughts and cultural expressions and musings of very interesting people across time and place, is kind of ideally suited for this kind of search for meaning and for finding a kind of social anchor for that search, a community that will support those kinds of reflections, the kinds of conversations that need to take place in order to advance one's own sense of who one is and how one thinks about these questions. But again, it's that same generation yearning for meaning that you just identified that's not taking courses in the humanities anymore.
Yeah.
So the question in part is, has the university become just one of those kinds of institutional locations that, like the community or like the church, has been jettisoned in favor of something else, or has been seen to come up short and to be found wanting when it comes to actually addressing those kinds of concerns? There too, and again, to go back to something I said before, I'm concerned that the hyper-professionalization of the university has gotten in the way. I'm also concerned that some of the debates in the humanities have gotten in the way. If you have, on the one hand, just this kind of sense of everything has to be critiqued, and on the other, a sense that the kinds of literary sources of looking into what it means to be a human being can only be accessed around, for example, a sense of who I am and not who somebody else is, or what is human, what is the condition of our humanity more broadly, that we're abdicating a role we might play in that search for meaning. All the other questions you've been asking affect this answer as well, because if it costs so damn much, and it really is a luxury, well, that's not going to be a viable place for people to go and feel they can spend the time and have the proper kind of conditions under which they can really take on those questions in a serious way. So they turn to the internet, or they turn to other forms of privatized exploration. And that, to me, is something the university has to think very hard and long about in order to try to recapture the role it used to play. So it's a great question you ask, and it underwrites a lot of what led me to write this book, but it also fills me with concern about what we're not doing right in the university today.
Nick Dirks, thanks so much for being with us at the Commonweal Podcast.
Dominic, thank you.
Nicholas Dirks's new book is City of Intellect, The Uses and Abuses of the University, and it's available now from Cambridge University Press. This is Dominic Preziosi for the Commonweal Podcast. The Commonweal Podcast is produced by Associate Editor Griffin Olenek and the Commonweal staff, in partnership with Sandberg Media. Wally Boudway composed the music, and David Dalt did the editing. If you like what you heard, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. And please share it with friends, family, and anyone else who enjoys thoughtful, in-depth conversations like the ones we have here. I'm Dominic Preziosi for the Commonweal Podcast.